2. Robin brought 2 mugs to the folding table and set 1 in front of Farley. "There you go," he said, as he sat down across from him. "Nice and warm, like Mama used to brew. Cheers." They clinked glasses and drank. The boiler room was full tonight, loud with chatter and thick with cigarette smoke. Kay Kaiser played on the armed services radio from the lone PA speaker on the wall. Beneath it were pinups. Beside Veronica Lake, a well-lettered sign read, "Keep 'em flying." Groups of men, few in uniform, sat at folding tables or stood in clusters at the bar, talking shop and gesturing. It might have been a dive bar near a college somewhere, except there were no women, and the gestures weren't what you'd see in a college bar. One hand held level and the other diving under it, then the leveled hand slowly angling out to turn palm up. 2 hands struggling with an invisible control wheel. 2 fists jerking in time as they swiveled an imaginary 50-caliber machine gun. Though technically it was an officer's club, there were plenty of non-coms. A few men had beers, most drank warm soft drinks. Farley realized he could tell who was ground crew and who was flight crew without having to think about it. The flyers simply looked older, dark circles under their eyes and a haunted, hunted look. They were 19, 20, 21. Whatever boyhood they had carried with them into service had been shot, shaken, blasted, burned, belly-landed, and grieved completely out of them. The boy in them had bailed out somewhere over the English Channel on his first mission. He was missing and presumed dead. Farley knew that he didn't look any different. Robin thumped his mug onto the table and wiped his upper lip and sighed. "Warm beer," he mused. "I'm turning into a friggin' limey." "They're not so bad. They've been around a lot longer than we have." "Yeah, yeah. They got socks older than us. I'll admit, they're brave bastards." Robin raised his mug. "Here's to every milk-white one of them." They toasted. "They can keep their damn weather, though," Robin added. "How in the world are you going to go back to driving a delivery truck after all this?" Farley asked. "I ain't no truck driver." "I thought that's what you did before you joined up."
"I'm more like a philosopher on wheels,"
Farley snorted. "You're something on wheels, all right." They were quiet a moment. Now it was Jimmy Lunsford on the PA. Smells of tobacco and beer and sweat. Steady hubbub and coiled tension.
"So what do you make of the Indian?"
Robin asked.
"He seems all right.
Handled himself pretty well after I threw him to the wolves." Robin nodded. "If he shoots like he pitches, he'll clear us a path all the way to the IP.
He was a ball gunner on another B-17, Farley said carefully.
"Had to bail out when they took hard flak." Robin whistled.
"Why didn't they just hand his crew a new bird like they did with us?"
"He is the crew."
"Oh."
The lieutenant nodded slowly. "That's a lousy break."
"It is that."
They were quiet again, both men thinking of so many who had been here so briefly. A sad parade of unremembered names and faces and truncated histories. To talk about them was to conjure ghosts, invite bad luck, dwell on whether that dread country they had entered lay in wait for you as well. It was not discussed.
"So how'd a belly gunner make it out and nobody else?"
Robin asked.
"Have to ask him." "I might just do that. What was his ship?"
Farley took so long answering that Robin thought he hadn't heard him. Then he said,
"Ill Wind." "Bullshit."
"That was his ship."
"Bull and shit. They were all dead on the Ill Wind."
"On her, yeah. He bailed."
"You're telling me we got a guy from the Ill Wind on our brand new bird?"
"Yes, Jerry, that's what I'm telling you." Robin frowned.
"That's some bad juju, Captain Pilot, sir."
"You sure you aren't just getting the heebie-jeebies about going up in a new boat?" Robin shrugged.
"I don't know. Maybe."
"You'd rather be on The Voice?"
"Not on Hermann Göring's worst day. That heap of shit was the best weapon Germany ever had. I miss her like I miss getting crabs." Farley nodded. He had inherited the voice of America after Henry Allen Logan had been killed by Flack, but he had never warmed to her. More important, she had never warmed to him. Farley liked the idea of a clean slate when it came to the bomber. Robin leaned back in his folding chair. So what happened on the Ill Wind? I think it's better if Martin tells it, but go easy on the guy, Jer.
Robin waved as if shooing flies and glanced around the club. The pinups on the wall, a dartboard not in use. The men drinking and smoking and talking RPMs and pull-up speeds, hydraulic failures and flak patterns and Luftwaffe tactics.
So who's the dame? He asked.
What dame?
The one you're about to fly all over Western Europe.
I already explained who she is. The legend?
Robin raised his hands.
Spare me the King Arthur stuff, Joseph. You handed Shorty everything but a photograph to work with. Come on, give. Whose puss we got plastered on our bird?
No one I know, I swear.
Robin studied him. That's not exactly a straight answer.
Farley shrugged.
It's an answer. The room went quiet. Frank Sinatra was suddenly loud on the wall-mounted speaker. Farley looked up to see Major Delvecchio standing in the doorway. He did not meet anybody's gaze as he slowly raised a hand to touch his cap. He gave a little nod and then he left. Robin's, well, shit, seemed loud in the smoky room. Men quietly finished their drinks and slipped out into the cold English night.
Guess I better go join the conga line, said Farley.
Why bother? Said Robin. When haven't we been on the assignment sheet? Better I should grill our ground guys.
The ordnance boys don't know any more than we do.
They may not know where we're going, said Brogan, but they know what we'll be hauling there.
Farley nodded.
I'll take what I can get, he said.
The flight line was a hive of activity. Farley put his hands in his jacket pockets against the cold as he walked along the row of Nissen huts to the operations room. He watched service trucks speed out from the bomb storage depot to the bombers on their hard stands, headlights taped over so that only narrow slits of light showed. Ground crew rode on the bombs in back like kids on a hayride. One of them was playing a harmonica, and the tones bent flat as the truck receded. Farley tracked one service truck along the taxiway until it pulled up by the Fata Morgana. He nodded to himself. Ordnance would be assembling and loading bombs most of the night, and the ground crews would be working on the ships till dawn. They never seemed to sleep. Most of them had been mechanics before the war, repairmen, some of them. They knew his bomber better than he ever would, and they worried themselves sick whenever their crate was out on a mission. Like parents loaning the car to a kid on his first date. They grilled you when you got back. How'd she do? What went wrong? How'd this or that repair hold up? And when ships didn't come back, they sat on their bicycles along the runway and stared up at the sky like some Stone Age tribe, forlorn at their god's abdication. At the operations room, a knot of pilots was gathered by the door. Farley greeted them as he worked his way toward the assignment sheet on a clipboard hanging on a nail. In front of Farley, Hap Saunders turned away from the sheet in disgust. Hap was a scrawny little cuss who flew the dollar short. He shrugged at Farley.
Why don't they just list who isn't going, he said. It'd save a bunch of time.
'Cause it'd be a blank sheet of paper,
said Hernandez beside him. Hernandez flew Montezuma's Revenge. As far as Farley knew, he was the only Latin American pilot in the AAF. He nodded at Farley.
Ordnance tell you anything?
He asked.
My XO went to get the lowdown.
I heard it's mixed incendiaries and M44s.
Munitions factory? Farley wondered.
I'm thinking.
Hernandez hurried away with Saunders. Neither had mentioned whether he'd seen Farley on the list. You found your own name on the assignment sheet, and if your name wasn't on it, you didn't mention that either. But of course it was there. Farley, Joseph M., Captain. They never listed the other crew.
They knew they'd be going with you. A touch on the shoulder at 0430 brought Farley from a deep sleep on his cot in the officer's barracks. He always slept well the night before a mission. He had no idea why. Most of the others tossed and turned and called out in their sleep, if they could get to sleep. Farley went out like a light and stayed that way. Robin said that Farley could sleep on a meat hook. So when Staff Sergeant Boatman, the operations officer, came in quietly and went from cot to cot, politely waking the officers on the mission roster, those who weren't already awake anyhow, Farley had to swim up from the bottom when his shoulder was shaken and his name softly called.
"Morning, Captain," said Boatman. "Briefing at 0530. Enjoy your breakfast."
And then he was moving on to the next cot. Robin was already getting dressed when Farley sat up.
"Shit, shower, and shave, Joseph," Jerry said quietly.
Farley blinked. "The service at this hotel has really gone downhill," he said. Robin nodded.
"New management. I hear there's an outfit in Berlin interested in the property, though."
Farley rubbed his face, unfazed by the activity around him. "If there's no coffee around here," he said, "they can have it." The crowded jeep slowed down but did not stop as it went by the dark shape of the bomber in the pre-dawn light. Martin, Garrett, Everett, Francis, and Shorty hopped off and shouldered their heavy Browning machine gun barrels in their oily sleeves. They waved thanks to the driver, who sped off to collect the next crew. Garrett and Everett headed for the waist hatch, griping all the way. Their bright yellow May Wests flapped in the cold, damp morning as the men heaved their parachute harnesses into the bomber and climbed in after. Francis went around to the other side, where he had his own little hatch at the rear of the aircraft for his tail gunner post. Wen Boniker was already doing a walk around with Case Miller, the ground crew chief. Wen was not a small man, but he looked tiny beside the stern, bull-like Bostonian with pant cuffs half a foot above his ankles and sleeves halfway up his forearms. Case had been a company truck mechanic before the war, and Wen nodded as the huge man pointed a thick finger at number 4 engine and gave a detailed account of its most recent service. Martin was layered up in thermals, wool uniform, leather trousers, and fleece-lined jacket, lined gloves stuffed in a pocket. He stood a moment and took it all in. Jeeps speeding crews to bombers, crewmen jabbering, trucks grinding through gears as they drove from the equipment shed for last-minute adjustments and repairs. Sounds of banging metal and tense laughter from inside the bombers. Vestiges of night still lay upon the field. The sun had a bad rumor at the horizon and dew blanketing the airfield. Tendrils of mist out near the fields, grassy mulch bordering the runways, a distant church spire. The B-17F Fata Morgana was covered with dew that sparkled like a coat of diamond dust. It was as utilitarian as an aircraft could get. No comforts, no amenities. The cabin was not pressurized or heated. Interior ribs and metalwork were all exposed. There was barely even a floor, lengths of planking and a bare metal catwalk to get across the bomb bay. The B-17 had not been built to deliver men, it had been built to deliver bombs. The men were provided what they needed to allow the aircraft to accomplish this and get back, and not one thing more. And yet every man who flew in one loved her, found a beauty in her aggressive form and purely functional design, a grace, even. They would fly in her, fight in her, bleed in her, curse her, even die in her. But they would never truly hate her. Any enmity a man expressed toward his bomber masked a profound disappointment and was grudgingly given only after being insistently earned. But unlike every other bomber here, the Fata Morgana was new. She was not patched or rewelded. She had never been shot at, had never taken flak, never burned an engine, blown a tire, dropped a bomb. She had yet to cross some remorseless boundary the other heavy bombers traversed like grim commuters, was not consecrated by the sacrament of blood and fear the other bombers wore like ghostly vestments. Wen glanced at Martin as he came around the B-17 with Case. Maybe the flight engineer thought Martin was working up his nerve to climb aboard. Martin didn't really care. There would be no other time to take this moment in. Finally, he took a deep breath and lowered his chest chute and heavy 50-cal barrels to the ground, and he approached the ball turret that would be his home for most of the mission. The yard-wide sphere protruding from the belly of the bomber would hold a small man barely, not a small man and a parachute, not even a small man in a full flak jacket. It had the best view in the house, and over pretty country it was awe-inspiring. In the middle of exploding flak and closing fighters and streaking tracer rounds, it was terrifying beyond the telling. Martin sat on the concrete with his legs on either side of the turret and made sure the brake was not engaged, then turned the ball until the ammo can cover faced him. He unfastened it and checked the two belt feeds. They looked like a madman's roadmap, but his trained eye saw that they'd been loaded correctly. He sealed the cover and then screwed the heavy twin machine gun bores into the gun assembly and rocked them on their cradle to be sure they were secure. Above him, he heard Garrett and Everett banging around inside the bomber, joking and swearing and giving each other hell. Martin glanced back to see Wen standing with his hands on his hips, watching him set up. Martin held his gaze, and Wen nodded approval, then turned to talk to Case. The two men ducked under the fuselage to enter the aircraft from the open bomb bay. Martin spun the turret again until the hatch faced him. He undogged it and swung it down and saw that a lineman had placed a flak vest on the hard seat like some kind of army elf. Martin checked the electrical cables and fuses, then backed out of the cramped space and sealed it up just as a crowded jeep drove up and slowed down to let Captain Farley, Lieutenant Brobin, Sergeant Mullen, and Sergeant Plavitz hop off. They had just come from the storage shed after the mission briefing, and they wore their flight suits and May Wests and carried their parachute packs. The jeep sped off to the next bird in the line. Farley gave Martin a two-fingered wave and set down his parachute. "All right," he called. "Everybody out of the pool." Shorty, Wen, Garrett, Everett, and Francis came out of the bomber from different exits and gathered around Farley under the wing.
"What's the word, Cap?"
Wen asked. Farley surveyed his crew. "We're bombing a munitions plant in Zenhausen, Eastern Germany." Garrett socked a palm with a fist. Everett held a hand out to him like an expectant bellhop. Garrett scowled and pulled out a well-worn fiver from his pocket. He held it by the middle and moved it up and down to flap it reluctantly into Everett's hand. Everett kissed it and tucked it into a pocket. "Listen to the rest," Farley told Everett, "and you might even get to spend that." He nodded at Plavitz, and the navigator removed a recon map from his accordion case and unrolled it on the concrete hardstand. He weighted it with stones and a 50-caliber shell. The crew squatted to study it. All of them were smoking except for Martin. "Intelligence says Zenhausen's a major munitions factory," Farley continued. "Reinforced concrete, dispersed production. A rail line runs close by it. Good news is, it's not a heavily populated area. No schools, no civilian neighborhoods nearby." He pointed at the map. "We'll meet up with a flight group from the 102nd Bomber Group out of Covent St. George, off the coast near Norwich. We'll head northeast and come in across the north coast of Holland. From there, we turn east and thread the needle between Bremen and Hanover. Those cities are heavily fortified, so we can expect flak."
"When can't we?"
Garrett asked. Farley pointed again. "We turn due south just east of Brunswick and drop on the target in a north-south line."
"What'll they have waiting for us at the target?" Martin asked.
"It's heavily defended," Farley said. 88s and probably some 105s. Luftwaffe bases are here, here, and here." He tapped the map. "So they'll be dancing at this party, too."
"The weather's nice, though," said Plavitz. He smiled thinly. "So that's something."
"This is a pretty big facility covering a lot of ground," Farley continued. "Our flight group's carrying M44 1,000-pound concussion bombs. The boys from the 102nd are carrying M17 incendiary clusters. They'll drop 10 seconds after we do. The idea is to crack it open and then light it up."
Farley surveyed the faces before him. None of what they were hearing was news, but it never got any easier to hear. Their thoughtful nods masked anxiety and fear. Farley would have had serious doubts about anyone who wasn't fearful of what they were about to do. Any questions? He asked. They shook their heads, pulling on cigarettes and staring down at the map of the country over which they would find their reckoning. All right then, said Farley. Let's get on the bus and go to school. Plavitz moved the weights off the map and rolled it up again. Farley waited until the others had climbed into the bomber. Then he reached up and patted the fuselage just under the painting of the graceful figure flying prone, the drop-shadowed script of her name, the metal cold and damp in the early morning. Don't let me down, gorgeous, Farley whispered. He wiped his damp palm on his jacket and then picked up his kit and ducked down to enter his new aircraft from the open bomb bay.